they all only got one vote in this race. And this is the only race that's been challenged and the only race that the court has to look at here.
After oral arguments in Anchorage, the Alaska Supreme Court rules Dean Westlake the winner of District 40. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, air quality advocates in Fairbanks file a third lawsuit against the EPA.
When the EPA doesn't make those findings, then communities tend to ignore their obligation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The Alaska Supreme Court has reinstated Dean Westlake as the winner of the Democratic primary in House District 40, which covers the North Slope and Northwest Arctic. The decision came in a ruling late this afternoon. It reversed a lower court ruling last week, which had tipped the election to the incumbent representative, Benjamin Nagiak of Barrow. Reached in Kotzebue, Westlake said he was absolutely ecstatic.
And when I got the news, I had to go for a ride. I'm sitting in my office, and I thought, this is wonderful that people that go to vote understand that absolutely no one is going to take that right away from you.
Nagiak could not immediately be reached. The court heard arguments this morning in the disputed primary election. The argument centered on events in the village of Shungnak, where poll workers let all 50 voters cast ballots in both Democratic and Republican primary races instead of requiring them to choose. The state admitted that was a mistake. But Assistant Attorney General Laura Fox, representing the Division of Elections, argued those votes should still count. Democratic primaries are open to anyone, so all the voters were eligible to participate, and it was only possible to vote once in the race, Fox said.
They all only got one vote in this race, and this is the only race that's been challenged and the only race that the court has to look at here.
Nagiak's lawyers argued that if poll workers had followed the rules, at least a few of those voters would have chosen the Republican ballot, possibly changing the outcome. Last week, a lower court agreed with Nagiak and threw out 12 votes in Shungnak and 2 in Kivalina, tipping the race to the incumbent. The lower court based that number on testimony from former Alaska Republican Party Chair Randy Reedrick, who calculated the average number of voters who chose the Republican-only ballot in the past 4 elections. But in its appeal, the state called Reedrick's calculation nonsensical, and the justices seemed to agree. Here's Justice Joel Bolger grilling Nagiak's attorney, Stacey Stone.
But is that really a matter for expert testimony? I mean, it's just math.
Bolger noted that Reedrick's math only included elections back to 2008, even though the attorney's brief included numbers going back to 2006, and the math changes depending on which election you include.
Is there anything in the record that shows why the 2006 results were neglected?
No, Your Honor. The only reason those results were neglected is because of the speed at which this trial happened.
But it only takes a moment to calculate these averages.
Yes, it does.
The 5 justices arrived at their decision within hours. In an order issued this afternoon, they reversed the lower court's decision, upholding the original election results. Only Justice Daniel Winfrey dissented, arguing the entire election should be voided and held again. Fairbanks area air quality advocates have filed another lawsuit aimed at forcing the Environmental Protection Agency to adhere to Clean Air Act deadlines. Areas of the North Star borough suffer from regular wintertime fine particulate pollution episodes as emissions from wood, coal, oil, and other burning are trapped at ground level by inversions. Patrice Lee, a coordinator with Citizens for Clean Air, says the suit filed against the EPA is specific to a missed deadline requiring reclassification of Fairbanks and North Pole as a serious non-attainment area.
When the EPA doesn't make those findings, then communities tend to ignore their obligation or they don't use effective means to clean up the air.
The latest suit, the third since 2014, filed Tuesday by Citizens for Clean Air and Alaska Community Action on Toxics, comes as the EPA considers dividing Fairbanks and North Pole into separate non-attainment areas. The state and borough proposal is premised on reduced fine particulate pollution readings in Fairbanks and consistently more severe air quality episodes measured in North Pole. Lee says more current monitoring shows neighborhoods in both communities can experience extreme pollution spikes.
There's pockets where things have improved. There's pockets where things have gotten worse.
Citizens for Clean Air has deployed its own network of air quality monitoring devices. The Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly approved funding this summer for dozens of similar monitors to better track air quality in more areas. A search is being conducted for a Fairbanks man missing since last week. Alaska State Troopers report 64-year-old James Hutchison last spoke to family members on October 3rd. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says a search for Hutchison is focused on the area around his home at mile 13.5 China Hot Springs Road. Peters says the local search dog group PAWS was doing a ground search and checking the river. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new collection of stories from LGBTQ Alaskans.
And our goal was to try to create a patchwork quilt, a complete view of the Alaskan queer community.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. As an Alaskan, you love your salmon. But do you know the things you can do every day to make sure they're here for your children's children? Well, find out what you can do to ensure healthy runs for future generations of Alaskans at salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The Sitka Police Department is on a bear hunt. There's been a recent spike in bear sightings around town and even a few close calls. It's not uncommon for bears to roam neighborhoods in search of trash, especially in the months leading up to hibernation. But as KCAW's Emily Russell reports, all the usual tricks for keeping Sitka's bears at bay haven't been working.
It's safe to say it's been a bad summer for bear encounters in Southeast.
A helicopter from Air Station Sitka medevaced two wilderness guides from Sitka Bay Thursday afternoon after they were mauled by a
troublesome brown bear was shot and severely wounded by a Skagway police officer on Saturday night at a campground.
A pair of Forest Service workers killed the charging brown bear near Sitka at the end of August.
There have been four maulings in the last 2 months. There have also been a few charging bears shot in self-defense. Lance Ewers is a lieutenant with the Sitka Police Department.
Kind of an unusual year, I think we could all agree, that there has been so many people that either had to defend themselves from a charging brown bear or actually were attacked by a bear.
But all of those encounters took place outside of Sitka. While there hasn't been a violent bear encounter or a bear killed in town this year, Ewers says tensions are rising.
You had the bear that broke into the car, which is the same bear that broke into two different people's garages, so that's three. Then you had the bear that chased the man on the bicycle. And that's four.
All within the last 2 weeks. And that list doesn't include the handful of bear sightings residents report to the Sitka police almost every night. Ewers says unless they're tied up with another call, an officer is sent out to respond to each and every one of those calls.
Sometimes the officer will blare the siren. Sometimes they'll beep the air horn. Other times they'll get out and yell at the bear. And 90% of the time the bear runs away, which is good.
But that hasn't been the case in recent weeks. Ewers says the pair of bears that have been tipping over trash cans and charging pedestrians aren't scared off by loud noises. So this past weekend, officers used rubber bullets on one of the bears seen wandering between Sitka's Indian River and Whale Park.
But they've gotten to the point now where they're not even affected by the rubber bullets. They just walk away.
The Sitka police and Alaska State Troopers have been working with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to find other ways to scare off the bears. Steve Bethune is a wildlife biologist for Fish and Game. He says they've tried trapping the bears as well, but even then, a live release wouldn't be likely.
Almost universally, when you move bears, they inevitably come back. So it's really not an effective strategy for eliminating the problem. And if they don't have come back, you've often taken that problem and given it to some other community.
So now, as Lieutenant Lance Ewers describes it, the strategy is to simply, quote, destroy the two bears.
If we have an opportunity to euthanize one of the bears that are between that Indian River area and Whale Park, and the officer could do it safely, then the trained professional officer who practices will destroy that bear.
Ewers urges residents to continue reporting bear sightings to the police and to stay alert, especially in forested areas. Another thing he urges the community of Sitka to do, keep your garbage indoors until the day of pickup. And if you, like Ewers, don't have a garage...
So I keep my garbage up on my porch until garbage day. And the day of garbage day, then I bring it out there because I don't want it to be my fault that, you know, a month after the bear got into my garbage, now they're forced to destroy this bear.
As for the two bears roaming downtown Sitka, their fates are likely sealed. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Russell.
This summer, a cleanup effort in Togiak National Wildlife Refuge removed more than a ton of junk from the area. For KDLG, Avery Lill has more.
Jennifer Johnston was the Student Conservation Association Directorate Fellow this summer, and she helped coordinate the effort to clean up the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. She describes the trash that they worked to remove.
The leftovers from old hunting camps or equipment that had broken down and was abandoned, snow machines or generators, things like that, you know, and other equipment, buckets and barrels and fuel containers, just things that served their purpose, and then people left them where they were when they broke down or when people no longer needed them.
She and the others involved in the project had to do a bit of reconnaissance. She spoke with refuge personnel and area residents to get a sense of where these sites were located. Then they had to find the sites by plane. Kara Hilwig is a pilot and biologist at the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge, and she explains the process of finding these sites.
So when we go and do one of these cleanup efforts, usually it's a pilot and a biologist or a intern. We go out there, fly over the site, and identify where all of the trash may be.
But it wasn't all chit-chat and an aerial observation. The cleanup itself was hard manual labor. The sites they cleaned this summer were all plane accessible, so they would land, process the debris, and load it up in airplanes.
With the metal stuff, we actually take an electric sawzall out there and cut the lids off of it and then jump on it, smash it down as flat as we can get it, you know, so that it's a consolidated, crushed up bunch of metal, and put a nice tarp down in the airplane so we don't get too much dirt and garbage in the airplane, and then load it up with all of this crushed debris and then take it to the landfill where it belongs instead of out in the wilderness.
To date, 5 sites have been cleaned up, but there's still a lot to do. More than 24 sites still need cleaning, and Hilwig says that she continues to spot new sites as she flies in the area. Some of them will only be accessible by raft.
Well, I think it's just going to be an ongoing project. It seems as though every time I go out and fly, I see something else and something else and something else.
The refuge is looking into grants and debris removal methods that will allow them to continue the cleanup effort in 2017. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
It's going to be a down year for crabbing in the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands fisheries this year. Several fisheries will be closed, and others will have reduced harvest quotas. The unwelcome news was not unexpected after a summer survey reported in late August that crab stocks were down. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The National Marine Fisheries Service annual summer surveys across the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands came back with the not good news. Miranda Westfall is the state's area management biologist based in Unalaska.
Overall, you know, we've been seeing the last couple of seasons of them surveying that crab stocks in general have been on the decline. So this season certainly wasn't a surprise for anyone either.
The news releases from Fish and Game trickled out all last week. First, the quota for the Bristol Bay Red King crab, which opens this Saturday, will be cut 15%. Then announcements came for the closure of Pribilof Red and Blue King crab, then the closure of Tanner crab, and closure of St. Matthew Island Blue King crab. The last announcement of a near 50% reduction of the snow crab harvest came out Thursday. Westfall says crabs are very cyclical, and she hopes to see things improve soon.
I kind of feel like just looking at past fishery data, past stock data, that we're just in one of the low cycles right now. The NIMS trawl survey happens every summer. And so we'll just kind of have to wait and see what it looks like next summer. But the hope is that it will turn around fairly quickly.
The BSAI crab industry is worth hundreds of millions every year. For example, in 2014, 108 vessels fished, employing 1,200 crew, and they caught some 81 million pounds of crab with an ex-vessel value of $246 million. The Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation has 9 vessels that fish crab. CEO Norm Van Vactor says these reductions and closures will be costly to the tune of millions of dollars for BBEDC.
There's less crab for the boats to catch. There's less crab for our salespeople to sell.
Right now, BBEDC and other crabbers are making some hard choices on how to optimize the efficiency of their fishing fleets this season. Snow crab and Bristol Bay Red King crab opens Saturday.
Do we tie a boat up? Do we move quota from one boat to the rest of the boats that are fishing? Do we just kind of share the pain equally between the vessels?
Decisions about crab harvest quotas are made after the NIMF's summer trawl survey data is in. Van Vactor says there are questions about how effective that effort really is right now in determining how many crab are on the Bering Sea floor.
There is a strong feeling, and we're certainly seeing it in our other fisheries, and in particular around our cod boats. They're seeing more crab than they've ever seen in a long time. So the feeling is that we are dealing with changing water temperatures. You know, we've had a warm blob, if you will, in the Gulf of Alaska. There have been different temperature currents in the Bering Sea. And the feeling is that the crab resource is probably actually quite healthy, but they're just not in their traditional areas.
Van Vactor says industry is lobbying hard for the North Pacific Council and the state of Alaska to consider changes to the way that trawl survey is done. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
One personnel issue has come to a close and another continues at the city of Fairbanks. Speaking at a city council meeting on Monday night, Mayor John Eberhardt welcomed Chief of Staff Jeff Jacobson, who was charged with driving under the influence this summer, back to work.
Let me just say this was a out-of-character incident with extenuating circumstances by a person who spent decades, literally decades, in service to North Pole, the city of Fairbanks, the Arctic Winter Games, and others.
Jacobson, who had been on administrative leave since the incident in which he drove off the Mitchell Expressway and hit a light pole, apologized before the council.
I'm just so very grateful that no one was injured as a result of my decisions that night. It's been an incredible life-changing journey since that night, and I'm just very thankful and appreciative to be back at the office and at work serving this great city and its residents.
Meanwhile, a second city personnel issue is ongoing. Police Chief Randall Aragon has been on administrative leave since being accused of operating a private security business. Mayor Eberhardt says the case will be looked into by an independent investigator, as requested by some city council members.
In conjunction with the city attorney's office and our HR department and my office, we got together and we asked our Alaska Municipal League insurer to see about coming up with a neutral investigator.
Eberhardt says the Municipal League has someone on staff with experience in investigations and police standards. He noted there are only allegations against Chief Aragon. Deputy Chief Brad Johnson is serving as chief in Aragon's absence.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The weather has been beautiful in southeast Alaska for 2 weeks straight, and that is very unusual. September and October are normally the rainiest months in the region. Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage who closely tracks Alaska climate data and trends. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. Brett Schneider says the two-week stretch of sunny weather has been remarkable.
This is the wettest time of year for almost every place in Southeast, and it has just been bone dry and quite sunny for the last, since about September 28th.
And give us an example, like take one of those weather stations.
Well, in places like Yakutat and Juneau, there's been no precipitation since September 28th or September 29th. And for Yakutat, they should have had 11.5 inches of rain. And for Juneau, they should have had about 4 inches of rain during that time period. And neither of those places have ever been completely dry for this time of year before.
Are we looking at any records here?
Well, records, a lot of times records are kept over, say, a month-long period. So it's too early to say if we're going to have like the record driest October. But for most major stations in Southeast, it has been the least rainy period for, say, half a month during this time of year. Definitely a historic dry spell.
What do you know about what might be causing the long dry spell?
So there's been a high pressure system that's been really centered, anchored over the eastern half of the state, extending down all the way into Southeast. And that prevents any storms from moving in. It's unusual to have it be so strong and so stable in one spot this time of year. So that's really led to the record dry spell.
And so can we make any predictions based on that, on what, you know, this winter will be like down there or long term?
It's really hard to say. I mean, we count on these storms to churn up the water and to dissipate heat in the Gulf of Alaska and the Northeast Pacific. And so without these storms, it may take longer for that heat to be dissipated, which would possibly lead to warmer temperatures. But that can change in a hurry. So we just need to keep an eye on that.
Brian Brett Schneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. Do you have a climate question for Brian? Email akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. Stories and poetry that celebrate the urban-wilderness interface in Alaska through the lens of LGBTQ writers is brought together in a new anthology called Building Fires in the Snow. Authors and editors Lucian Childs and Martha Amore helped bring it all together.
Pretty much immediately I saw it would be a lot of work, and so I turned to my old friend Lucian and asked him if he would be interested in co-editing the collection.
I had to think about 20 seconds before I said yes, because we are literary artists, and so that's the tool that we can use to bring the stories of LGBTQ people to out there. And so we just didn't feel like those stories were being told. And one of the things that people crave so much is to see their lives on the page or see their lives on the stage or on the screen. And so I thought it was a great project. And our goal was to try to create a patchwork quilt, a complete view of the Alaskan queer community, which is really quite diverse and quite vibrant.
The collection of stories, as we've just been discussing, is from members of the LGBTQ community. But you said in part of the writing that the stories relate to concerns that all Alaskans share. Flesh that out a little bit for us.
The reason that we say this book is of interest to any Alaskan is because each piece really transcends the specificity of somebody's particular lifestyle and really gets to other issues that are just more universal human issues. And of course, they're all works based in Alaska. So really anyone who's interested in literature and lives in Alaska will appreciate this book very much.
I think our lives have become more integrated with the general community, and we now don't feel the need to live in specific neighborhoods. We're outed in our workplaces. We have a broad spectrum of friends, and so what I say when I think about this book is this book is actually a portrait of Alaska. But it's told through the lens of the LGBTQ community. So you have stories about two roommates clearing a wasp nest out of an attic, or two women trying to find a place to rent, which is a situation that does go to the core of being queer in a state that is not always accepting.
You've had events in several communities in the state and a panel discussion in Anchorage. What have the conversations been like? What's been the reception, and what's the temperature in Alaska for the issues that you're raising?
We've been really touched at the outpouring of support here in Alaska. Every community we've been to has had great events, and we've had amazing audiences. Gosh, in Homer, we had a really interesting discussion that ranged from pronouns for transsexual or transgender people and through to the craft of writing. It just ranged from politics to literature and back again.
I was really going to talk about Fairbanks because that's most recently in mind. We just got back from there last weekend. And the thing that really amazed me were the number of young people. We had reached out to the Gay Straight Alliances at the high school and the university, and we had a lot of young people. And the one that really touched me was a young transgendered man who came with his mom. And they sat right in front, and he came up with his book, and we signed it, and we asked him, "What's it like for you, you know, to live here?" And I was amazed to find that he felt very accepted in his high school, and so it was very heartening to see that it really does feel like a new day in terms of how LGBTQ people are in Alaska.
Tomorrow evening at the Anchorage Museum, there will be a reception at 5 p.m. and a 49 writers event starting at 7 p.m. that will feature discussion and stories from the new LGBTQ anthology called Building Fires in the Snow. Links to the book are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Annie Fite in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Russell in Sitka, and Avery Lill and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The Alaska Public Radio Network, in cooperation with our member stations, provides the most complete, timely, and accessible source of Alaska news, current affairs, and cultural information.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.